In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
It is July 2nd, 1776. It is a mild summer day in Philadelphia, a change from yesterday's thunderstorms, but frequent showers still spatter the windows at the Pennsylvania State House, where yet another speaker has taken the floor. At this very moment, George Washington is busy building defensive bulwarks all around New York Harbor. He'd left Boston 2 months ago, arriving with 19,000 men to reinforce the city, 19,000 recruits that you had authorized. It's been 14 months since shots were fired on the greens at Lexington and Concord. Since then, there have been some 24 battles in which several hundred men had died, and only one major battle, the Siege of Boston, in which nearly 2,000 men had died. Up until this moment, there was still a chance all of this could be walked back with diplomacy and concessions. In fact, you had tried. A year ago, you had sent the king the Olive Branch petition. Your efforts to repair the relationship had been rejected, in part because before the petition even reached the king, a letter from John Adams to a friend was confiscated and leaked. In it, Adams said he thought war was inevitable and that Congress should have already raised the navy and seized British officials. Not that it mattered, because the king refused to even read it. A king who is 3,500 miles away. You pay taxes to him, but there is not a single representative for you in Parliament, for you or for anyone in the colonies. No one. No one to argue for your case, to ask for leniency or justice. Instead, the king declared the colonies in a state of rebellion. You have spent a dozen years trying to repair the damage. You have sent envoy after envoy to the king, and he has rejected and ignored all of your grievances. His response has been not to reconcile, but to punish. With more taxes, more troops, blockading harbors, and seizing property to make it even harder for you to pay the taxes that he demands. He has made his intentions clear. He will beat you into submission by force and by punishment. And here you are, listening to another speech, and you are about to commit treason. For real. There is no going back after this. Your reasons better be good ones. They are. You have helped craft and edit, and you are about to vote on the Declaration of Independence, outlining your economic, philosophical, religious, and moral reasons why this social contract is at an end. These words that you have helped craft will launch a nation. You don't know it, but in the days ahead, the Declaration will be hailed as a masterpiece and read and reprinted and read again in cities all across the colonies. Washington himself will have it read to his troops, troops who can see the British unloading their ships across the harbor on Staten Island. Because first, a war must be won. Without the actions, your words will mean nothing. War lies before you, but in the years that follow, your words will be carried like a torch to all parts of the globe, shining the light of freedom and liberty to all who would throw off the shackles of tyranny. Your words gave rise to independence and revolution. And not just of war, but a revolution of thought and mind and spirit, that mankind was and is meant to be free. That mankind is endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and for the support of this Declaration with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Welcome. This is the I Spy Radio Show. It's our annual 4th of July show. I'd like to welcome Greg Leo. In his day job, he is a lobbyist and consultant in the areas of marketing, politics, and public affairs. He is also an avid amateur historian. We like to refer to him as I Spy Radio's in-house historian because he is our guest every year for our annual 4th of July show. Greg, it's always a fun time when we have you on.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's my favorite holiday, the 4th of July.
Oh, me too. Christmas is probably my overall favorite, but 4th of July certainly ranks up there. And in large part because it is a time where we really come together as a nation. We put aside a lot of the political rancor and anger, and even in the darkest times, we have found ways to come together as a country. It doesn't always last, unfortunately, but we and, can at least focus on it for a little while.
And that's been the history of our country. I mean, you know, patriotism has been so important to America when America is going through the dark times.
Yes.
And it's important, I think, to kind of parse through the idea of patriotism, the love of our country and the love of the American ideals, but not necessarily the love of the government or any specific policy. And as we look at the earliest days of the Republic, we can see how that evolved through,
yes,
you know, our opposition to the stamp tax and to other British policies.
Yeah. Well, you know, for this year's show, I thought we'd focus on those first 50 years of our nation. You know, we always like to have sort of a focus for these annual shows. In the past, we've focused on celebrations on the original frontier as America expanded to the Mississippi. Another year, we focused on the 4th of July celebrations on the Oregon Trail. Last year, we focused a lot on the English Civil War, which put forward many of the arguments for freedom and liberty that later became the spirit of the American Revolution. But like I said, I think we ought to focus on those first 50 years between the signing of the Declaration and the anniversary. Before we get going on that, though, let's set the stage a bit to put our listeners there in America in 1826. Give us some of the highlights of what was happening. Things were actually pretty good at that point, weren't they?
Yeah, 1826 was a great milestone. Of course, it's 50 years from the time of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. You know, John Quincy Adams was president. The country really had extended to the West Coast. There was joint occupation of the Oregon Territory between America and Britain. And it was the country was like a coiled spring ready for westward expansion.
Yes, and also I think some of the other things that were weighing a lot in people's minds, you know, we'd survived not just one, but two wars with Britain. The Industrial Revolution was in full swing. There was a tremendous amount of railway and road expansions. The Erie Canal had just opened in the fall of 1825. There was a national newspaper at that time, and as part of covering the Erie Canal, they had mentioned that there was no fewer than 102 other canal projects in other parts of the nation were underway. So there was a tremendous amount of economic activity at the point.
Yeah, and Gallatin's idea of public works, which was kind of a pillar of the Jefferson administration, had really taken root by that time. The commerce, as you point out, it was growing, but it was really linked to transportation. There had been a concern in the country in its very earliest times that as we expanded west, that the Piedmont area, the coastal area along the East Coast, would become depopulated. That did not happen. Actually, population increased across America between the, you know, between 1800 and 1826. So in 1826, the country is doing extremely well. And there still are political parties. There's lots of controversy. But economically, America is doing quite well and is about ready to go through a huge expansion phase.
Hmm. How many states did we have at that point? I think it was 24. Is that correct?
Sounds right. Yeah, that sounds right. Primarily the East Coast states. And, of course, lots of territories in the West. You know, the West is still largely unpopulated. And, you know, the Great Migrations would happen 20 years later in 1843 with the Oregon Trail. So this is kind of pre-Oregon Trail. This is kind of the high tide of the trapping. You know, trappers were on the Missouri River and, you know, headed up towards the Pacific Northwest. But at this particular time, you know, California is still Spanish, as is much of the Southwest. America really was not fully into the area west of the Mississippi.
Hmm. At the time, in 1826, there would have been very few veterans of the Revolutionary War still alive. But I imagine nearly everyone knew someone who had fought, and I would think that would add a special flavor to that Jubilee celebration.
Well, they really did. The elderly folks at that time, there were people who had fought in the Revolution and knew about the Revolution. You know, to give you an idea, Oregon has the only Revolutionary War veteran west of the Rockies, and they're buried in St. Paul. And they came to Oregon during the Wilson Hunt Price Party, which was, of course, the Astorian fur traders that came overland. And, you know, William Cannon is a good example. The fact there's only one, you know, west of the Rockies tells you that you know, we really had not had expansion, you know, in a major way across, you know, the country to the West Coast at that time.
Yeah. All right, let's go ahead and take a break right there. Coming up, we'll be looking at those first 50 years of the United States. We weren't quite as united as you might think. Find out what was pulling us apart after this. And welcome back. It's our annual 4th of July show here on iSpy. We're talking with Greg Leo, who is our go-to historian, our guest every year for these annual shows. We're focusing on the first 50 years of our nation this time around, a fascinating time that actually has a lot of disunity, which is very similar to what's happening today in many ways. Greg, before we get going into those first 50 years, there was just something that I find very fascinating about that 50th anniversary. They had this committee put together by Roger Waitman, who was the mayor of Washington, D.C., and he was really in charge of putting together the plans for this big celebration. And they had invited all of the surviving signers of the Declaration of Independence, of which there were only three at that point: John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and Charles Carroll. And then also they had invited the living presidents. In addition to Adams and Thomas, there were still James Madison and James Monroe. All of them declined. But there were some fascinating letters that were sent, and one of the ones that I'm just going to tease for later on in the show is a fascinating letter that Thomas Jefferson sent as part of that, and it was so wildly received that they ended up reprinting that in all sorts of newspapers all across the United States, and so we'll have to come back on that one. But in researching this show, it really surprised me that those first 50 years of the United States had such a great deal of partisanship and fighting. And a lot of people know about the disastrous Articles of Confederation, and we had to kind of basically do a reboot. And then there was, of course, a battle to reform under a new constitution. But what were some of the things, really, in those first 50 years that were constantly threatening to pull us apart?
Well, the political parties really developed, you know, during the Washington administration. And, you know, Adams, being a Federalist and being from New England, it was a different orientation towards the role of government. Government needed to be a strong central government. It was more based on the ideas that Hamilton had about the monetary system. And, you know, the Federalist Party was one that really believed in, you know, that the federal government should be strong. On the other hand, Thomas Jefferson, who was an agrarian populist, felt that it should be a distributed power, that power which should be, out among the people. And the people then would then be the source of power that would give authority to the government. So these two political philosophies came into harsh conflict. And, you know, we think we have harsh politics today. Those politics were terrible back then. Of course, newspapers were organized along the lines of their ideology. There were things that were said that would make us blush today. Between Jefferson and Adams. And so the country really was trying to find itself in terms of what would be the role of government, what would be the source of power for the government, how would the government evolve. And so Adams was our one Federalist president. Jefferson followed with, of course, his expansion, of the country through, Lewis and Clark and what we saw with the Louisiana Purchase, but also expansion in terms of public works and more of a populist role of government. So anyway, this was the great conflict, and it was harsh, and it questioned the unity of the country. So the idea that patriotism and love of the country, regardless of party, regardless of ideology, was a very important thing. And this is why 1826 was so important, because that is really when America came through, and not as a political party idea or as a battle between these two ideologies, but rather for the love of the country, and the ideology then becomes secondary. So by 1826, the year that both Jefferson and Adams died on the same day, which happened to be the 4th of July, everybody at that time saw that as kind of a divine intervention. That this was a way of, of God saying that America was truly that city on the hill, and that its two founding fathers, who had really diametrically opposed philosophies, joined together to make the country something that would sustain itself over time.
Well, it's really interesting to hear you talk about the newspapers being divided along ideological lines. We certainly see that today. where you've got Fox News versus CNN. I mean, they don't exactly say that they're for the Republicans versus the Democrats, but it's pretty clear they both have a very strong ideological bent.
In the old days, the pamphlets, anybody could, you know, get a printing press and put it in their, you know, their basement and print their point of view. Similarly, with our electronic technology, it's really been a very dispersed system of how you can put out your information today by the internet and, you know, through emails and through blogs. And so media has become more democratized in a way because of social media. And it becomes a very similar kind of situation as the founding fathers had, which is great from a Democratic point of view, because you hear all sorts of different perspectives and Americans become more choosy, if you will, of ideology. And that is not a bad thing for our country. That's the source of how citizens are engaged in, you know, the government that's by and for the people.
Yes, very much so. In terms of the two parties, I mean, Washington had warned us against this, that it was going to end up pulling people apart, and sure enough, it did. And aside from the size and control of government, were there other issues that the various parties were arguing over?
Well, taxation was a key issue. And the Federalists, of course, because they wanted to support a stronger central government, had whiskey taxes and other taxes, which were, you know, very unpopular amongst populace. Whereas populace said, if you don't have a standing army or navy and you don't have to, you know, financially support a large central government, then the money can stay in the hands of the people. And so really it was the power of a battle over taxation and the power of the purse that really was at the foundation of this. And over time, it was the Jeffersonian idea of people controlling government rather than having a strong central government, which prevailed, at least in the near term. Now, that may have changed later in American history with the Roosevelt administration and, you know, more of a government-oriented. But the point is, it's always been a question between populist power or central government power.
Yes.
And that's a theme which exists today.
Yeah. But yes. And that, like you say, I mean, that is the theme today. Who is going to control things, whether it's the people or the government? All right. Lots more to come as we continue our thoughts here with Greg Leo on our annual 4th of July show, talking about the first 50 years of these United States. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show, talking about the 4th of July. It's our annual 4th of July show with Greg Leo. He is a lobbyist and consultant in the areas of marketing, politics, and public affairs, and consults with cities, tribes, and politicians, and individuals and businesses as well. You can contact him at greg@theleocompany.com if you'd like advice in any of those areas. So we're talking about the first 50 years here of the United States, and in a lot of ways it's kind of surprising that we actually made it through it. There was a lot of disunity there, not just with the parties, but we also had the War of 1812. I mean, we very nearly didn't make it. And one of the things that was fascinating to me that happened, and we really started to see the decline of the Federalist Party, was they called it the Hartford Convention. And this was a secret meeting of the Federalists called by the governors of New England. So often today we see these secret meetings behind closed doors, and there we are. This same sort of thing happened back then. But the Federalists were upset and met at the Hartford Convention. This was in late December through January of 1815. And they were upset about the ports being closed and the effects that the War of 1812 was having on the New England economy. And among other complaints, they even considered putting forth a proposition to strike a separate peace deal with the British. Clearly, this was divisive and even possibly creating a situation where they would have seceded from the Union. We always know about the war between the North and the South, but we very rarely hear anything at all about a secessionist movement happening there in New England.
Well, you have to realize that New England was really maritime, and most of the people along the coast were affected dramatically by our trade, by our foreign trade. So the ships that were built in Massachusetts and in Philadelphia, you know, up and down the eastern seaboard, were really about trade with Europe. And so they're, you know, the triangle of, you know, taking American raw materials to England, going down the Caribbean, picking up sugar and rum, bringing it north and et cetera. So, you know, that trade was super important. And so because of the impressment of sailors we basically got into the War of 1812 as Britain was trying to keep its Royal Navy working against Napoleon. And, you know, so it was in the economic interests of the Northeast to try to end that so that American trade could continue. So the Hartford Convention, you know, really was kind of a closed group, a closed meeting, and it flew in the face of the populism, the agrarian populism. At that time, you know, 90% of the people in the country lived on farms. And so the trade of produce and, you know, turning natural materials into finished goods was in the very earliest stages. So it hastened the end of the Federalist Party as populism saw that a larger government would decrease the role of agrarian agriculture, and they felt it was unnecessary. So in a way, it was these sectional conflicts, which were really economic conflicts, which drove this. But as the country began to move west, more of the populism, more of the Jeffersonian ideas of self-government took hold. And of course, by the time Jackson had been elected after the War of 1812, the populism was absolutely entrenched.
Yeah.
And so really, in a way, Jefferson won the argument long term.
Yeah, he did. And like we've mentioned earlier, the Federalists were really much more about a very strong centralized source of power. Mm-hmm. They were mainly located in the Northeast there, the Federalist Party were. And it was interesting what happened afterwards, because at the time of this convention, the governor of Massachusetts had already sent a secret peace envoy trying to negotiate a peace treaty with England, not realizing some of the other things that were happening. And after that convention, they had dispatched an envoy, essentially, to Washington, D.C. They had five proposed constitutional amendments. They wanted to prohibit any trade embargo lasting over 60 days. They wanted a two-thirds congressional majority for a declaration of an offensive war, admission of a new state, or interdiction of foreign commerce. They wanted to remove the three-fifths representation advantage of the South. They wanted to limit presidents to one term. I mean, you know, there's your term limits of the day. And they also wanted to require that each new president be from a different state than his predecessor, in large part because of the dominance of Virginia in the presidency. So they're carrying this list of grievances. And by the time they get to Washington, oops, Jackson had already won decisively down in New Orleans, and the Treaty of Gaunt had been passed. So this was hugely embarrassing to the Federalists, and this essentially began their demise.
That's right. The British, when they lost the Battle of New Orleans, which, by the way, happened after the Peace of Ghent.
Yes.
You know, it took so long for the news to get back to America that was the final really ending of that entire situation. But also, that was kind of the end of the Federalist Party.
Yes.
Because at that point, it was quite clear that the country was independent. It was growing. It was more populist. And that's really when the Western expansion was ready to go.
Yeah. Well, what also impressed me about that convention was, again, its similarity to today, really the entire intention of that convention was to undermine the president, James Madison at the time, and to embarrass him. And yet it completely backfired on him.
Yeah, that you have to put the partisan politics aside and do what's right for the country.
That's right.
And that patriotic idea is really started, I think, in 1826, when you did have kind of the last vestiges of the founding fathers, with, you know, Adams and Jefferson dying on the 4th of July that day. And people then said, well, no, it's the American ideal.
Yes.
That's going to live on. And so this idea of we're going to put our partisanship aside, at least for the 4th of July, honor our country and the flag, honor those ideals which protect our freedom,
yes,
and our rights beyond just the partisan day-to-day workings of the political system.
That's right.
That idea became prevalent in 1826. And in a way, that was the beginning of why we celebrate the 4th of July today.
Yes. And as you said, that really led to the demise of the Federalist Party, because after the Hartford Convention, the Federalist Party really became synonymous with disunion, secession, and treason. And the party was ruined after that. So it's amazing what happens when you focus on making America great, dare we say. All right, lots more with Greg Leo. Stay with us. And welcome back. It is our annual 4th of July show here on the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Greg Leo, who is an amateur historian, although that just means that he doesn't do it as a paid profession. In his day job, he is a lobbyist and consultant in the areas of marketing, politics, and public affairs. You can reach him at greg@theleocompany.com if you have need of any of those services. So, Greg, after the Hartford Convention in 1815, which really began the demise of the Federalist Party, we really saw the dominance of the Democrat-Republican Party. They held the presidency for the next two election cycles. The Federalists didn't even run a presidential candidate in 1820, just a VP, and officially dissolved in 1824. One of the accomplishments of the Democrat-Republican Party was uniting the country, especially as the country headed to that big 50th anniversary. And that was really one of their big accomplishments, I think, because you could see how the country was really starting to come together. We'd had
we'd also fought two wars with England.
Yes.
And so America had really been established as an ongoing, country. And in a way, we had had a dynasty of, Virginians who were really more agrarian, but Virginia had been the linchpin post-Revolutionary War up to about this time. And, really, Monroe was the last of this dynasty. Hmm. So sectional power had been now shifting west as, the migration moved out across the country. So this era of good feeling was very good for the country in the sense that there was less partisanship at that time. And this is a time when the industry of the country really started to develop through the transportation projects like the Erie Canal and, the beginnings of building railroads and having ways of getting, produce and other kinds of goods to eastern markets. Mm. So, the country is really prospering, developing this time, and a time when politics took a bit of a back seat and economic development took the front seat.
Well, it's always fascinating to me how when people really focus on coming together and they focus on that unity, what great things can be accomplished. And I think we're right on the cusp of that right now here in America. Just looking back at those 50 years between the signing of the Declaration and its anniversary, as we discussed in the last segment there about the fall of the Federalist Party, which was really trying to undermine the president and really create a huge amount of disunity. Just the notion that they would send off their own peace envoy to England to try to negotiate their own way out of the war. I mean, what a hugely divisive thing.
Yeah, American interests, need to unite at the water's edge. And the idea that when we get involved with foreign conflicts or negotiating with a foreign country, that there would be different envoys, that really is dangerous because, of course, the threat would come from other countries that would come in and try to divide America as the British thought of doing during the Civil War. And, mm-hmm. of course, the Germans, proposed in the Zimmerman letter, which caused the First World War. So the idea is very dangerous for one political group to go externally to try to get allegiances and that kind of thing. So we have to put the national interest first over what might be an ideological interest or, some kind of a sectional interest, as we see with the Hartford situation. So, of course, this is a time when we've just defended ourselves against one of the greatest military powers in the world twice and beat them on our own ground, but only after our national capital had been burnt and, there had been widespread raids.
Yeah.
And really an effort to, on our part, to take Canada, which failed. So this was a time when people said, hey, that's kind of enough of that. Let's develop economically. Let's grow the country. Let's take a look at what can happen with those Western lands.
Well, I just think it must have been so shocking for so many people that as more and more came out about the Federalist Party, how they were really trying to sabotage the interests of the entire nation for their own interests and for their own economic interests in some ways as well. And I think that actually helped unify people in the years after the war, that we really did start seeing ourselves as that nation. And here was this one group that was trying to sabotage us, and let's put that aside. But then Monroe, he had a goodwill tour, essentially. And one of the things that I found fascinating is he went right into the heart of the Federalist areas. In fact, that term, the era of good feelings, happened after he'd toured through Boston and met with so many of the Federalists to try to rebuild those bridges. And
good lesson for today.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
Donald Trump could take a page there and go into the heart of his opponents and, you know, have that discussion as well. And that takes a strong, confident leader to reach out like that and kind of go into the enemy camp to, you know, build an alliance and basically unify.
Yes. But what was also interesting, too, mm-hmm. was that he didn't then, which we hear so much of now, is, oh, we've got to reach across the aisle and give them positions of power. Actually, Monroe took the very opposite track, where he acknowledged their differences, didn't deride them, but at the same time, he also wouldn't give them any bit of power. And I thought that was interesting, that he did not want to give their philosophy of a strong, overpowering federal government any sense of power or control. It was much more about diversifying that power, and that was really the focus of America, because that's how we were founded. Let's go ahead and take a break. Coming back, we'll be talking about that famous Jefferson letter for the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Stay with us. And welcome back. It is our annual 4th of July show here on the iSpy Radio Show. Talking to Greg Leo, he is an amateur historian, lobbyist, and consultant. He consults on matters of marketing, politics, and public affairs for cities, tribes, and individual politicians and businesses as well. You can reach him at greg@theleocompany.com if you have need for any of those services. Greg, so there is this fascinating letter that Jefferson had sent when he was declining the invitation of the mayor of Washington to be there for the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And it was so widely received that they end up reprinting this in a number of newspapers all across the country. And we'll make sure that we put the entire letter up on iSpyRadio.com. Just look for today's show page. And I just want to read a couple of little excerpts here. And just the phrasings of these are so fascinating. He talks about what a joy it would have been to have been there with that small remnant of the host of worthies who joined with us on that day in the bold and doubtful election we were to make for our country between submission and the sword. I just love that phrase, that they were making a choice between submission and the sword.
Mm-hmm. And they put their lives and their sacred honor on the line. And now, 50 years later, he's writing about the context of this. This document really stands right along with the Declaration of Independence, I think. And he makes some comments here about the palpable truth of, you know, our natural rights as men. And when I say men, I mean men and women, that, you know, the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. In other words, we don't have classes. This applies to everybody equally. Everybody has these natural rights, you know, of freedom, opportunity, and the rights to keep government at bay, to keep them away from unreasonable searches and seizures, quartering troops, all of the things that the British had done to individual people. So this document really is kind of like an addendum to the Declaration in that it describes those ideals which really apply to all in America.
Yeah, well, it certainly reinvigorated the embrace of the Declaration of Independence. And as you said, this really launched the annual celebrations for the 4th. I mean, they were kind of scattershot through those first 50 years, but it really became much more of a tradition thereafter. This letter that he wrote, it was actually the very last letter that he would ever write. He died on the very day, July 4th, 1826, that he'd been invited to help celebrate. And again, just to continue some of the excerpts here, here's another one. May it, meaning the Declaration of Independence, be to the world what I believe it will be, to some parts sooner, to others later, but finally to all, the signal of arousing men to burst the chains under which monkish ignorance and superstition had persuaded them to bind themselves and to assume the blessings and security of self-government. I mean, what a great encapsulation of what the Declaration of Independence was, this notion that we had allowed these kings to control our own lives. We had allowed the expansion of government to take control of us, and that Declaration of Independence was breaking those chains that we had bound ourselves with.
Absolutely. And it's so fabulously well said, but this is the core of why we had the revolution, why we formed self-government, why we wrote the Constitution to protect our rights, and, you know, for that to live forward. And so this is a fabulous statement of that. You know, on the other hand, they were talking to Adams at the same time, who died mm-hmm. almost exactly at the same time. You know, his statement was, you know, tell us what thing we should remember. And he said, celebrate independence.
Yes.
Celebrate this day, because this is the day that will remind people that these were hard fought for rights that everyone needs to, you know, hold dear and keep in their hearts in order to fight for again, that this is not over. This is always an evolving situation where people want to take away your natural rights, and that you need to celebrate that independence annually to make sure that we keep that torch lit.
Well, and the notion of self-government, I think that's the other thing that you know, here we are 250 years later, or getting there anyway, and we really forget that the notion of what our founders did was so novel in the world. I mean, it was really the first time that we'd ever done this.
It was a huge experiment, and yes, it was so risky. And it was paid for by blood and treasure. I mean, there was so much, human suffering that had happened to make sure that independence, you know, happened. I mean, it was a near run thing on several occasions. Washington's army was almost snuffed out. But somehow, by divine, you know, intervention, through just pure grit, Americans won their independence. Now we have to keep it. And we can't let, you know, the kind of politics of the day erode those things that are fundamental to our basic natural rights as men.
Well, and it was such an overwhelming victory, too, in the sense of what we're up against. I mean, the Americans decided that they were going to go up against the strongest nation in the world. I mean, that would be like some little almost third world country now deciding that they were going to go up against America. And it's just incredible to think that not only would we dare to do it, but that we actually won.
And that the ideas lived on, and that the world, as Jefferson suggests here, has changed to become more like us, more representing those individual rights and freedoms. And that's that, torch which will light the entire world. So this is where we put, you know, normal politics aside, partisanship. We think about those greater ideas, and we celebrate the fact that now we've had, you know, an American experience, which is so good for individuals that it's being replicated around the world.
Yes. And it, unfortunately, that does lead to some arguments in terms of how much governance we will end up being under. Okay, be sure to stay with us. We'll have more on that Jefferson letter as we wrap things up on our annual 4th of July show with Greg Leo. Welcome back. This is our final segment now on our annual 4th of July show, Talk with Greg Leo. You can contact him at greg@theleocompany.com. And Greg, we were talking about the famous letter that Jefferson wrote declining the invitation to the 50th anniversary celebration that was happening in Washington. And there's just another excerpt here that I just really have to read, because it really does encapsulate the focus on self-government. And he says this: "That form which we have substituted restores the free right to the unbounded exercise of reason and freedom of opinion. All eyes are opened or opening to the rights of man. The general spread of the light of science has already laid open to every view the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God." I mean, what a great way to put this is that we were, once again, endowed with rights from our Creator. We are not meant to live under the booted few, as he puts it.
Right. Which is, of course, a total rejection of monarchy and the idea that you are born into some kind of a higher status. But rather, it's about each individual pursuing happiness, as he said in the Declaration, in their own way, and defining happiness in their own way, and having the economic freedom to be able to do what they want to do in life in order to support themselves, to worship their own God in the way that they see fit, to have speech, to be able to say what they want to say, to be able to assemble with people with like ideas, to discuss those ideas, these basic freedoms of, you know, of people in a free society. And he's the one who says it so articulately that his words are relevant today.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And he closes it with this: these are grounds of hope for others. For ourselves, let the annual return of this day forever refresh our recollections of these rites and an undiminished devotion to them. Again, what sweet words those are.
Well, and thus is born the 4th of July. So if you ask the question, why are we celebrating the 4th of July? Jefferson says exactly why there. This is a reminder.
Yes.
You know, this is a reminder that this was battled over, and we'll have to fight for it again and again and again to make sure that we maintain these natural rights of men.
Yes. We've talked about this letter from Jefferson, and there was also at the time, as they were putting together the 50th anniversary, there was a number of letters to the editor that were going out. And it was interesting to read through some of those because politicians were despised even then. And there was a lot of there was one in particular that was sent: many worthy citizens feel that office seekers and demagogues often monopolize the proceedings, and it is undignified to share in them. So they're trying to get people together, but they didn't necessarily want the politicians there.
Exactly, because they tend to divide. You know, the arguments that politicians use to attract support are basically saying we're right and the other people are wrong.
Yes.
And that's what we see today. There needs to be a time where we set aside those differences, but rather honor and celebrate the basic freedoms and the basic, you know, idea that this is government of and by the people.
Yes.
Regardless of party or, you know, ideology.
Yes. And that's exactly how that letter to the editor finishes. He says, but if those who sincerely wish to commemorate the nation's birth turn out, the monopoly of those politicians can be broken and the politicians discomfited. I love that. Yeah. Again, it comes down to the people. And that is really what we satisfy, this notion of self-governance. Before we get going, you'll have an annual 4th of July as well. Why don't you talk to our audience a little bit about the Newell House? It seems like whenever we've done this in the past, it's always, well, it's coming up like tomorrow. You better hurry and get there. Now there's a little bit of time because this will air on Saturday.
Sure.
And the 4th, of course, isn't until midweek.
So come to historic Newell Village at Shampooey at 4 p.m. on Independence Day, on the 4th of July. There's a two-hour ceremony, basically, that we have where we read the Declaration of Independence. We take the Declaration and break it up into about 60 parts. People of all ages, you know, from kids to senior citizens, read one line of the Declaration. And it really gives us an idea of exactly what people were thinking about. This is a time-honored tradition to remind people about their rights. Additionally, it's going to be about transportation and steamboating on the Willamette River. We're going to talk about the steamboats of early Oregon and how they, you know, plied the river and brought the produce down from Willamette landings down to the ships to sail out around the world. And so there'll be quite a bit about steamboats. Also, a great pie contest. If you love pies, we will have, you know, over 20 people baking their best pies, a contest to see which is the best, and then the pies will be auctioned in order to support historic Newell Pioneer Village.
Is there a cost to get in?
No, it's free.
Yeah.
And we encourage, it's a free event. People should bring their lawn chairs. We will have bluegrass music there from Corral Creek, which is a very popular bluegrass band, and it's going to be absolutely a fabulous event. We hope everybody can make it to Newell Pioneer Village, right adjacent to Shampooey Park, on the 4th of July at 4 p.m.
It is a great event. I've been there. I would highly encourage any of you with families to make it. Greg, unfortunately, we are up against the clock. It is always fun, and wishing you the best 4th of July.
Celebrate your freedom.
What a fascinating look back at what was driving us apart and what eventually brought us back together. It's a good lesson not to let political parties separate us. The Federalists disappeared because they weren't supporting America or America's interests. Why would you want that party around? Shouldn't America be the focus of all of us? Let's get back to that. America first. If we can put aside party politics and put all of our energy into making America successful, we truly can, dare I say it, make America great again. And that's something you should want no matter which party you belong to. Be sure to check today's show page on iSpyRadio.com. There's a lot of fun links up there, including some pictures of actual Revolutionary War vets who had lived to see the invention of the photograph. Go ahead and share those, leave a comment or two, and as always, remember that the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.